Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and a co-chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. I will be your chair for tonight's program, Island Practice, with Pam Bellick, a health and science writer for the New York Times. I'm also fortunate to introduce Katie Hefner, who will introduce Pam. And she will also help with our interviewing to discuss Pam's many outstanding contributions to health, science, and medicine. Katie is a regular participant in Commonwealth Club programs. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, writing on healthcare topics. She is the author of 6 books. The title of her newest book is Mother, Daughter, Me. It is a memoir and will be published by Random House this July. Tonight's program is sponsored by the Health and Medicine Member-Led Program with Bill Grant as the chair. And now I'm happy to turn the program over to Katie Hefner. Just one last thing to tell you. Every once in a while, you'll see me pop up to remind the radio that we are broadcasting. So when you see that happen, I'll sit back down, and we will continue with the program. Katie, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Ann. And I will now introduce Pam Bellick, who has been on the staff of the New York Times for more than 15 years. She currently writes about health and science, but she has been a national correspondent and has, I have to say, I mean, it says in the flap copy of the book that she's covered everything from cattle rustling to embryo adoption, and that doesn't really even begin to convey the creativity of Pam's reporting. I mean, she's one of the most creative and smartest reporters at the paper, and that's a place full of smart, creative reporters, I can tell you. And she's won a lot of awards, and she's had a Knight Fellowship and a Fulbright, right? And we're really lucky to have her, and it's really because of this book. And one other thing she does that I'll tell you about briefly is she's also a very accomplished jazz flutist, and she's going to actually, she goes around and does jazz. She plays with a group and then occasionally combines it with the book as a kind of book event, which is really, really just wonderful. So anyway, Pam, thank you so much for coming all the way across the country to, I know it's a hardship assignment coming to San Francisco, but we're really lucky to have you. So of course, I've been dying to ask you this. So finally, I will pop the question. How did you get this idea? And first of all, let me just say that the idea, the title of the book is Island Practice. And it is it's a joy to read. It's this romp through sort of every possible malady that one could possibly find on Nantucket. And therefore, as Nantucket is such a small island, off of Cape Cod, it's a microcosm of what happens in the larger world of doctoring. And she focuses on this one extremely, and there are no words, there is no superlative or anything to tell you that this guy is probably one of the most eccentric people, much less doctors, that you will ever read about or meet, as Pam did. And you read it and you think, this can't possibly be true. This guy can't possibly exist. And of course he does. And this book is a full length portrait of him, his life on Nantucket, the people who come to him with absolutely bizarre diseases and symptoms. He's also an absolutely amazing diagnostician. And so how did you get the idea to write this book?
Well, first, thank you so much for that incredible introduction, and it's a real honor to be here talking to you all, and a special honor to be talking with you, Katie, so I really appreciate it. Thank you. So 5 years ago, I was the New York Times New England bureau chief and was just asked as part of a kind of staff assignment to find somebody in my region who was not famous, had not been written about before, but who was just doing something interesting in an interesting place. That was, those were the marching orders. And you know, I'd been in New England for a few years, and I had sort of a kind of informal list of people who were kind of quirky, and so I was considering, there was a guy who was running a nude bowling league in Maine, and you know, I was thinking about this, and but you know, the times we were just sort of starting to have video, and they wanted to be able to illustrate this. I thought, you know, a family-friendly newspaper, this is probably not going to fly. I wasn't all that excited about getting too close to the naked bowling guys anyway. So we passed on that one. And then there was a guy who was trying to make Vermont into its own country. Vermont was going to secede. And I think the idea was that everybody was just going to survive on Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey or something. And, you know, we thought about that for a little bit. And then I just sort of found it. This just kind of tells you, you know, the desk of a New York Times writer just flooded with paper. And there was, for some reason, I had saved a copy of the Tufts Medical Center alumni newsletter, and it just had one little line about its one alum, Timothy, I thought it was Lepore at the time, said, is the only surgeon on Nantucket. I thought, oh, okay, I'll give him a call. And we had just such an engaging phone conversation, and he was just so interesting in just a brief conversation. So I went out there, did a piece for the Times with some video, spent a few days out there. I really had not been to Nantucket except for about half a day a few years earlier. And immediately that story ran, immediately after it ran, I got calls from book people, and people saw something in there that I didn't quite see yet.
I mean publishers,
but, publishers and agents. Interestingly, I found out recently, you know, the book has is actually been optioned. It's being developed into a TV series by Imagine Television, which is Ron Howard's production company, and 20th Century Fox. And the screenwriter is this incredible feature film writer named Amy Holden Jones, who has written movies like Mystic Pizza and Indecent Proposal. And she told me a little while ago that she had actually read that original story at the time and thought TV series. And so she had been kind of, you know, thinking about it. And then when the book came out, she was very excited to put her hat in the ring to write the script. So it just... it just ended up being this incredible adventure for me, getting to know this unusual person and the work that he does. And what I loved about it and still love about it is that, you know, there's a lot of quirky and funny things and eccentric things, as you say. But the background of it is, you know, every day he's doing life and death work. He's in these situations that can only crop up in, well, they crop up everywhere, but they're, you know, sort of writ small on this island, and you can see all the drama of, you know, what happens when you have somebody about to die on your table, or somebody you know, with a serious situation and you can't get them off the island.
Right, that's a huge thing, is that you, it's so hard to get off the island. So if you have some life-threatening thing, it's, how do they do it?
Exactly. It's you know, it often falls into the hands of Dr. Lepre. He's not the only doctor there, but he is sort of the go-to doctor there. You know, he's the surgeon. He's the medical examiner. He's the football team doctor. He is the tick disease expert. He will fix up your animals. He has a sort of somewhat unorthodox psychological counseling method. You know, he'll do everything, and you know, the fog rolls in, you can't get a flight out. This is a small hospital, 19 beds, one operating room, 6 units of blood, which is really enough for one kind of major operation, and that's it. And he has done things with you know, baling wire essentially and bubble gum, but, you know, not quite, but almost.
So when you told him, hey, I think I'm going to actually write more than just a 1,000-word article about you, I'd like to write an entire book. How did he respond?
Yeah, I have to say that I have been so fortunate with him as a subject because personally, I mean, I've been writing for the Times for a long time, and I do all manner of stories, as Katie said, but I don't do very many profiles, and I don't particularly like to do profile type of writing.
Why is that?
Well, I often feel like it's very hard for a reporter, a journalist, to take a journalistic approach to a profile where you don't get too close to your subject or where, more importantly, where your subject isn't trying to spin you in one way or another. And I have actually had situations, in fact, including one recently, where I was going to do a profile of somebody for the Times, and we just ended up not doing it because everybody that we were talking to clearly had been sort of gotten to in some way, and it just ended up not being that interesting because you just felt like people were giving you kind of the talking points. So I didn't actually expect this book to be as much of a profile as it was, but it turned out that everywhere I turned, Tim Leprey was kind of the fulcrum. He was kind of at the center of all this drama and amazing stuff going on. And so it just ended up being that way. But as a person, you know, I came to him and I said, you know, there's interest in this as a book. And if I do this, it will be a journalistic book. You know, I'm just going to do what I do. And he said, fine. And, you know, he never once tried to keep me from talking to somebody or, you know, there's a malpractice lawsuit against him that I write about in the book. Never once tried to spin that. He talks very openly about how difficult that was for him. There's a lot of sensitive family information that he and his wife Kathy and other family members were very open about as they, you know, came to sort of spend time and I was very open with them about what I was interested in. And so we had a very good, very trusting relationship where I think he didn't know what to expect. He didn't read the book beforehand. But
before it came out, you did not show him the
book. He saw the galley, but before that he didn't see it. And it was kind of interesting because I sent him the galley, you know, the advanced copy, and there's a little window time to change some stuff. And I'm sitting there kind of on tenterhooks, you know, thinking, what's he going to say? And there was one thing, only one thing, that he had a couple of medical accuracy corrections, which were great. But there was only one thing about himself that he wanted added. There's a whole section about all of these odd hobbies that he has. Siberian throat singing, collecting dog hair to knit dog hair sweaters, making his entire family eat polenta for some reason, on and on. And one of the somewhat less eccentric ones is that he was an amateur boxer at the Nantucket Boys and Girls Club. And there's a quote in there from his brother-in-law, who's also a police detective, saying that he's a terrible boxer, something like he couldn't break an egg or something like that. And Dr. Leprey read that, and he said, okay, yeah, you know, that's fine. But I want it known that I was the heavyweight champion in my age class, he's just turned 68, at the Nantucket Boys and Girls Club. And I said, really, Tim? I mean, isn't that sort of like being the tallest building in Wichita? You really want that in the book? He said, yes, you know, I was beating up people in wheelchairs. I was about to go to the nursing home. I said, okay. And so it's in there. And as with almost everything, once he would sort of raise something or I found out something, he would elaborate in such a way that it became, you know, wonderfully colorful.
So just a journalistic side note that is a really, it's a reporting tour de force on Pam's part. I'm reading this book, right, and I'm a journalist. I should know this. And she has interviewed everyone all of his patients, and there are many in this book. And I'm thinking, wow, how great that Pam went out and interviewed. And then I'm thinking, oh my gosh, of course she had to, because they were his patients. And it's all about HIPAA. And so there's this patient-doctor confidentiality. So you had to go ask every single one of them. And we're talking about some very, very famous people, such as?
Chris Matthews. John Kerry is a long-term patient of Dr. Lepre's and was treated for a tick bite in the middle of his presidential run and was a little surly about that. And by the way, Dr. Lepre is not exactly what you would call a Democratic sympathizer. This is a guy who not only listens to Rush Limbaugh, he plays Rush Limbaugh for his dogs when he's out of the house. And he essentially saved the legs, the walking ability of Ted Kennedy's father-in-law. So everybody comes to him, whether they are famous people or whether they're the South African immigrant who can only pay him in oatmeal raisin cookies.
Right.
That's
one
of the wonderful things about it, the diversity and the diversity of approaches that he has to these people, too.
He does. He does take payment in cookies,
yes.
Apparently. And but he's also extremely, he will treat anybody. I mean, people show up at his house in the middle of the night, right?
Much to his wife's delight, yes.
Right. I mean, the wife, I was just wondering, I mean, how did she handle all of it?
She's incredible.
Just
a wonderful person who also does try to get him to set some boundaries and is marginally successful at that.
I mean, you do wonder, I mean, the thing you think about Nantucket is, I mean, I've been there, I'm sure a lot of people have been there, and I've been there a couple of times, and it's like seems like this sleepy little place, even in the summer when it's just teeming with tourists, and you think, oh, nothing must really happen here very much. And then you read Pam's book, and it just seems like it's just riddled with these bizarre conditions. For instance, can you tell us about the woman with the narcolepsy?
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
It's got there's another accompanying disease that goes with it?
Right. Well, so Dr. Lepre, you know, I'm always very skeptical as a health writer. You always hear people are brilliant diagnosticians, and I'm always sort of like, yeah. But actually, it turns out that he really is has this steel trap of a mind, and he reads everything, and he seems to pluck these odd diagnoses out of the air when other doctors have missed them. He came upon a patient, a woman named Alexandra McLaughlin, who had only recently come to the island, and she was falling down all the time. She'd go out to walk her dog and she'd just collapse. Or she would, anytime she felt like a strong emotion.
Usually happiness, right?
Could be. If she was very happy, she saw a delightful scene, she had to start thinking about puppies in a washing machine or something, you know, so that she could balance herself out. Otherwise, she would collapse. But also, if she thought of something very sad, she would have to think of something, you know, silly to counteract that. Or if she got startled, I mean, people would like honk their horns to say hello to her on the street and she would immediately collapse. And of course she'd been, you know, seeing all these different doctors and everybody had thought of one thing or another. They thought she was faking it. They thought she had bipolar. They thought she had a brain tumor, you name it. And she goes to Dr. Lepre, and he says, you know, let me help you figure this out. For him, it was just fascinating. And it turns out that she has narcolepsy, which, you know, is a sleeping disorder, but it's accompanied by cataplexy, which is what happens when your muscles kind of just give way. And she has a very severe case of it. So he was able to help her not only figure out what it is, but there's one... there's no real treatment. There's one drug that was recently approved to treat it, which is essentially a date rape drug. It's very, very dangerous.
A date rape is what she said.
Yeah. And it had been illegal for about 20 years because people were you know, using it in date rape situations, but someone figured
out...
The
perpetrators were using it, just to make it clear.
But somebody had figured out that it would be potentially useful for narcolepsy plus cataplexy, because basically it knocks you out for sort of 4 hours, that you wake up, you take it again, and it knocks you out. And if you can regulate your sleep cycle in that way, it apparently is helpful to people with this condition. So, but it's incredibly expensive and highly controlled, and he was agreed to sort of sign up for this federal database where he has to monitor her, and somehow he figured out a way to get insurance to cover it. And she's doing much better now. She still has this issue, but she's told me that she can drive if it's not raining, if the radio's on, if she's singing something at the top of her lungs, if she's eaten something before she got, you know, she has certain things she's able to do. And there was a great anecdote recently, I'll click to this picture if I can, where she's a very, as so many people are in this book, she's just a real eccentric character herself. And so Vice President Joe Biden is another one of the celebrities who comes to the island for Thanksgiving every year. And he was here, he was there this last Thanksgiving, and she was determined to find him and talk to him because she wanted to talk to him about health care, and she wanted to thank him for health, for Obamacare, because it has helped her in her situation. So, let's see if I can do this.
Can you get it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there it is. So she finds him.
So she finds him. She actually has people looking out for him, and then she hears that he's on a bench downtown, and she goes and she sits next to him, and she starts talking to him. But, of course, she's very excited to be with this celebrity. And what happens when she gets very excited is that she starts to have a little bit of cataplexy. And so she did. And she ended up collapsing on the vice president, who thought that she was leaning in for a hug or something, and ended up giving her a little peck on the cheek. And now she has this lovely picture of herself with Joe Biden. But you know, she's generally better than she used to be.
So back to Dr. Lepre as a doctor.
Yeah.
He's very, I don't know how to, if the word is cavalier about being a surgeon and surgery, but there was something he said, there's a quote I wanted to read to you. I mean, he performs a lot of emergency appendectomies, of course, and cesareans, and he says, and he's very, very colorful in his speech. And one thing he says is, oh yeah, cesarean, it's a semi-mindless procedure you can do if you have opposable thumbs. And so, what's that about?
I mean, you know, that is so interesting because, right, we think of surgeons as having this God complex, right? And everything that they do, they frequently will portray themselves as being, you know, having only this magical ability that they can do. And one of the wonderful things about Dr. Lepre is that he really thinks that surgery is, as the title of that chapter is, you know, he just says, it's cut, sew, and tie. Really, anybody can do it, you know. And for him, it's, now, of course, he's minimizing the skill involved. There is a lot of skill involved. But what he's trying to say is that the difficulty is in the judgment. You know, when do you cut, you know, how much are you supposed to do? And what's the proper way to do it?
Well, and he's also kind of surprisingly without ego as a surgeon, because he would know when he could do it himself on the island and when someone really needed to be taken pronto over to, what do they call it, America? Wait, what?
Yes, yes. The rest of the country is America.
Right. And, and that's a wonderful quality in a surgeon, because there's really very little hubris. I mean, it's interesting. He seems to have kind of a combination of he's all about hubris,
right,
and there's none of it.
Right. He speaks like a cowboy, but when you come down to it, he's actually a very careful clinician. And it's this it's just one of the many things that I kept finding, where there were these great juxtapositions in personality and in just the kind of things that he does.
And then he also seems to approach medicine with a real sense of wonder. I love this quote. He said, and because he's delivered a lot of babies, and he's also saved a lot of women from their lives from hemorrhaging. And he said, "I have great respect for what can come out of the vagina, some wonderful kids and lots of bleeding." And he said there are lines like that all over the book. And
yes.
It's not that he's unfiltered, or is he maybe a little
He's a little unfiltered, I would say. It's all part of he calls it as he sees it. And he sees a lot of stuff. He's seen a lot of things that go into the vagina as well. There's a
whole chapter,
section on things that people put in their orifices. And this was a lot of fun for me as a New York Times writer, I have to say, because we have rules about getting that kind of vocabulary into the paper, and I didn't have any problem with getting that into the book, so it was a lot of fun.
Ah, the liberty.
Yes.
So, and then there are some things he does that seem kind of borderline crackpot, like the, tell us about the obsidian scalpel.
Oh, yes. So, one of his hobbies, he's fascinated by Paleolithic history. And he got on this kick where he was flint knapping, where he's carving things. And he decided that he was going to carve scalpels out of obsidian, which is a volcanic glass. And somewhere I have a picture. I think I have one here. Aha, there it is. They're really beautiful. And he says that they're very sharp. And he has convinced people to let him do appendectomies with them, and hernias and ear draining procedures, and he might say I'll do it for free if I can use my obsidian scalpel, and it's worked very well.
And doesn't it like break off?
Well, it can break off. That's one of the problems. One of the pitfalls is that it can break off, but as he says, because of the composition of it, if it does break off, you can see it on X-ray and then you can remove it. I don't think he's ever actually had one break off. But he had to stop doing this because everything was going swimmingly, but he was trying to figure out how to sterilize them, and he had a hospital on Cape Cod that was sterilizing them, because you can't sterilize them with high heat the way you do for a regular scalpel. So he had them using a certain gas to sterilize it. Turned out that the gas was a carcinogen, so he had to stop. It was like on an EPA banned list or something. So he had to stop. But we do have a picture, actually, of him in the operating theater with one of these scalpels. And I just thought this was funny, because
if you can't read it, it
yes.
says that a doctor, the surgeon, is asking for the simple stone tool.
Yeah, this was in the New Yorker recently, and it's just really sort of vintage leprey there. It even looks a little. Don't you think it looks a little bit like him?
Well, we should put a photo of him up because now that we're all
so
curious.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio broadcast with Pam Bellock and Katie Hefner about Pam's book, Island Practice.
So one of his hobbies is collecting guns. Can you tell us about the 200 or so guns that...
So here he is giving me a tour of his gun collection. It's really interesting. I mean, he is in Massachusetts, the bluest of blue states. And he's an NRA member, and he's an avid gun collector, mostly old guns. He's very interested in the history of them. He can tell you chapter and verse about each one, and he's fascinated by them and has been since he was a child, and he has no idea why, really, but it wasn't something that he grew up with in terms of his parents didn't do that. But one of the things that I found so fascinating is that he shoots them all, usually on a shooting range or sometimes hunting. He's a deer hunter, not a very good one. But one of the things that I found fascinating is that you know, he's on this island and he has this incredibly pressureful job where he's not turning anybody away in any situation.
Ever.
And, you know, you can psychoanalyze this a little bit, and which I sort of tried not to do, but I think it's fairly obvious that some of these hobbies are, you know, he doesn't drink at all on the island, because, and a lot of people
tell us,
on
can
the
we
island
digress
do.
For one second yeah. to tell us the story about the non-drinking?
The non-drinking, yeah. So, it was early on when he got to the island, he was at a dinner party and just had, I think, a gin and tonic, and got a call that a 14-year-old boy had had a terrible moped accident. He ran into the hospital and basically just did whatever he could do to save this kid, and he wasn't able to save him. And he wasn't at all impaired, but it was a cautionary tale for him because he said, you know, what if I had had a second gin and tonic? And so from that time on, he had never drinks at all on the island. This is an island where there is a lot of drinking, and it's somewhat of a fishbowl kind of place where people do turn to that, some of them. And so I think that some of these hobbies are his way of kind of getting out the stress. And the way that he described shooting guns, which he does frequently, is that it's the only thing that to him involves the same kind of concentration and precision of surgery, so that when he's shooting, he's not thinking about surgery. He's not thinking about the patients and not trying to second guess, did I do the right thing? Did I use the right anesthesia? You know, could I have done that more artfully? You know, how come I didn't get a good outcome there? For some reason, the guns take his mind off of that. And so it's interesting. He keeps them, you can see in that closet there, is usually closed and locked, and it's protected by a tear gas canister. And one time it actually went off in the face of the local fire chief, who had heard a hissing and was going down to look at what that was, and opened the door and got gassed in the face. So, and they're still good friends. So, you know, he's able to keep up these relationships even when he gasses people. And I like this picture because these are guns he keeps in his kitchen, and he's I don't know whether he's trying to, you know, shoot the book or what he's doing there.
It's a photograph of Dr. Lepery with island practice. So what I'd like to do before we open it up to questions is I'd love for you to hear a little bit of Pam's writing and preface it with telling us a little bit about his pet hawk, Ajax.
Sure. So this is Ajax. She is a red-tailed hawk.
A she-hawk.
And Dr. Lepery's had her for a long time. And he's very devoted to her, and one of the things that he does to feed her is he goes out and early in the morning and scoops up road-killed rabbits. And people all over the island know that if they run into roadkill or, you know, I was there one time and there was like this paper bag outside by the mailbox and it said squirrel for Ajax. Nurses will bring in rabbits into the hospital for him, so he has quite a close relationship with his hawk, and I think you're going to read a somewhat alarming tale, right?
Yes.
About should I set it up or do you
yeah,
just want to read
go
it?
Go ahead and set it up.
So this was the lepers have three children who are all grown now. They're all involved in medicine in some way, in healthcare. Nick is the youngest, and when Nick was 11 or 12, he and his dad went out hunting with Ajax to try to scare up some rabbits for the hawk. And it didn't go all that well for Nick.
Okay. As Lepery recalls, Nick wasn't working particularly hard. He was lollygagging instead of beating the brush trying to get rabbits moving. Suddenly, Nick recalls, he heard a woof and whipped around. There was Ajax with its wings fully spread out and its talons and feet pointed. I ducked as quickly as I could and it went whap on the top of my head. Grappling for a secure hold, the bird, quote, started refooting and plucking out tufts of hair. The bird is on my head, Nick screamed, immobilized with terror. My dad said, I'll be right there. So nonchalant, a friend of Lepery's displayed more urgency. Charging through the brush and ordering Nick not to move, he reached down, gets the bird off my head. It felt like a half hour, but I'm sure it was about 5 seconds. The hawk punctured holes in Nick's scalp. Blood cascaded down. But Lepery did not react the way Nick expected. Nick, go sit in the car. There's about 20 minutes of light left, he said. I just want to hunt a little bit longer. Nick gaped at his father, thinking, are you serious? I have blood streaming down my head. Hiking through the brush to the road, he approached the only house. An old couple answered. My dad's bird attacked me, Nick panted. They were patients of Lepery's, naturally. They brought Nick inside, where he got cleaned up and drank orange juice. As Nick left the house, his father, having finished hunting, approached, notably unruffled. He looked like a waif in this bloody T-shirt, like something out of a horror movie, Lepery recalls. They were just little puncture wounds, but on the scalp they really bleed. Nick realized later that his father, quote, knew it was nothing serious. He just didn't take into account how I didn't know that. I was never angry at him about it, to be honest. I was fine, and he was right. He has made a lot of sacrifices as far as his time, and this day was his chance to do something fun. I should have blamed him somewhat, but I just blamed the bird. I told him to never let me watch that bird if he's out of town, because when he comes back, it's going to be stuffed. The incident, quote, made its way around the island pretty quick, Nick recalls. After all, I had a tuft of hair missing. He'd expected people would be shocked, but Nantucketers knew their doctor. Of course, people said. Of course he told him just to go wait in the car. So what I'd love to do is open this up to questions.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California and our radio broadcast with Pam Bellock and Katie Hefner about Pam's book, Island Practice. And Pam will be here after the program tonight to book sign, so please meet her after the program tonight. And we are at that point of time when we can have questions from the audience. So if you will raise your hand, I will be right there. Be sure and speak into the microphone.
I have a question. When you first described this book, I would have thought that all the names would have been changed, and you'd have to keep all these patients secret, and you'd never get them to agree to let their medical stories be told in this book. But yet, somehow you did. How did you do that?
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I get that question a lot, and I guess the way that I approach these kinds of things is that I just try to be very open with people and direct about, you know, why it is I'd like to tell their story. And most people, not everybody, but most people are willing to talk about their experience, and they have different motivations for doing it. Sometimes it's cathartic for them. Sometimes, I think in several cases here, even if it was difficult for them to talk about it, they felt that it showed something important about what Dr. Lepery was able to do, and they want to contribute in that way. Sometimes they feel that they can help other people by sharing something that they've gone through. So I didn't really have too many difficulties with getting that. I'm really interested in what people have to say, and I'm very straightforward about it. And I find in my Times writing that's the way it usually works too.
And our next question.
While considering HIPAA, how did you know who these patients were who had interesting stories?
Yeah, well, what would often happen is that either I was there in some cases, or Dr. Lepery would mention a case that he had, without giving me a name. We would be talking about all manner of things. And I would say, oh, well, that's really interesting. Do you think that patient would talk with me? And so he would reach out to that patient, and if they agreed, then I would talk with them. So, I in those sorts of situations, I always went through him first. I would never, you know, I just tried to be very respectful of his relationship with them and what situation they were in. And they were, you know, there weren't that many people who were not willing. There were a few people who, for very understandable reasons, did not want their full identities used. And in a couple of cases, I made that decision myself with a child in particular, where I only used the first name, even though we had permission to use the full name. So we tried to be sensitive in those circumstances.
Thank you for your wonderful talk.
Oh, thank you.
I see here, could you say something about, you wrote about embryo adoption, and did you go to Colombia and South Korea, and what is a National Bureau Chief? Some of your other things.
My other stuff, yes. So asking about my New York Times work. So, let's see. For about 10 years or 11 years in my work for the Times, I was a National Bureau Chief, first covering the Midwest, based in Chicago, and then covering New England, based in Boston. And the nature of those jobs, there's just a lot of variety, and I was always very interested in, and still am, kinds of the things that drive me are stories that are surprising or off the beaten path or counterintuitive, and that say something about the way people live or about the struggles that they go through. So a lot of the stories that I did sort of fell into that umbrella. And more recently, my trips to Colombia and South Korea were both for... As a medical writer, I have been doing an occasional series of stories on Alzheimer's. And that started when I learned about a family in Colombia, which is the largest family in the world to experience Alzheimer's. They have a gene mutation that causes them to get Alzheimer's very early, in their 40s. And I went to Medellin and to the mountains outside of Medellin and spent in some pretty dicey areas and spent some time with these families and also with the scientists who were working with them. And what we found was that they are providing scientists with this amazing opportunity because right now there's really no treatment that works for Alzheimer's. And the clinical trials that have been done, these drugs fail, probably because they're being tried much too late. And this family provides an opportunity for scientists to test medicines much earlier because they know that these folks are going to, they have the gene, they're going to get the disease. So partly as a result of our stories, this project got one of the very first grants from the National Alzheimer's Protection Plan, which is the new thing that the federal government has, and they have just started testing a drug on these family members as long as 15 years before they were developed symptoms of the disease. And if it works, then it could be groundbreaking for the rest of us. So,
Embryo adoption.
Embryo adoption. So that has to do with fertility clinics. When people go to fertility treatments and they produce embryos and they don't use all of them, they're stored. Some people don't want to see them destroyed or used for research. So they essentially adopt them, have them, have them implanted in another woman, so that they can ideally turn into babies. So it's a kind of controversial issue. Deals with the abortion debate. It deals with the whole issue of when life begins.
Because of the fertility drugs that they have
Yes. Yes.
Oh, the question is it because of the fertility drugs?
Yes.
And you still are a staff writer for the Times?
Yes, yes. I'm a health and science writer. So,
Hi, Pam.
Hi.
In your time on the island, did you see the Good Doctor almost an extension or a slight exaggeration of some of the eccentrics that are there and have persisted over generations?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think that my impression of Nantucket, and I always stress that I am an outsider chronicling this, you know, as a journalist, and I have, you know, great respect for and gratitude for the people that I met and who spoke with me, and you know, so my judgments, my impressions are as an outsider, but and from hearing what they were telling me, but my impression is that it is an island that attracts a lot of very interesting people who see it as a place where they can go and be offbeat and be a little out of the mainstream and be creative. And Dr. Lepre fits right into that spectrum. He's not the weirdest guy there. There are others. But this is a place where, as I say in the book, that would let Lepre be Lepre. He can be, you know, the latest hobby that he has is collecting rabbit skulls. Why? There's always a reason. Because he has decided he wants to figure out, are there any New England cottontail rabbits left on the island as opposed to your garden variety Eastern cottontail rabbits? And the only way you can tell is that there's a slight difference in their skull. One, the New England has a jagged little joint on the top of the skull, and the Easterns are straight. And so he has these skulls, I don't know the technical term, sort of defleshizing in formaldehyde in his yard. It smells terrible. And he's going to answer that question. So, you know, but there are other people that do, you know, kind of odd things. And I think it's this being 30 miles out to sea, being in a small community where these kinds of differences are tolerated and celebrated, you know, just being literally and figuratively able to separate yourself a little bit from convention.
Did the doctor speak to you, or did you ask him at all about what might be like a succession if he decided to either A, slow down, or B, retire, or C, be taken out of the, you know?
Yeah, this the succession issue, what happens when Dr. Lepre is no longer there or retires is a big issue for the hospital and for patients there. And he has not really given any indication of slowing down, but of course one day he will. And this is a very big issue because it's going to be very difficult to find somebody who is both a surgeon and who wants to do all of these other things. Because there's not enough surgery, really, on the island. There aren't enough continual flow of cases to keep one surgeon, you know, kind of happy if all you want to do is surgery. And many surgeons don't want to do other kinds of doctoring. And they want to have more resources at their disposal. So it's going to be a real big problem. And the head of the hospital, Margot Hartman, said to me, I just quoted in the book saying, you know, my nightmare is succession planning for Tim Lepre because there really isn't somebody, that, you know, right there willing to step into his shoes.
Any more audience questions at the moment?
There's one up here.
Oh, good. Okay.
What's the doctor's relationship with other doctors or healthcare providers on the island?
You know, it's interesting. I think I heard from several, so there are about four other family practitioners. And then there are some doctors at the hospital, and there are some off-island specialists who come in. And I heard from many of them that their first impressions of him are, you know, to be sort of off-put. You know, he's also another one of the hats he wears. He's the medical director of the hospital. So one of the things that he does every year, to his great delight, is that he gets to give a presentation at the Board of Trustees meeting. And it's this incredibly irreverent presentation, and it's kind of insulting to the hospital board, and he just loves it. And so people tend to, not everybody, but they're on first meeting, there's often this kind of impression, like, who is this guy? But to a person that I spoke to, as soon as they had to sort of see him in action medically or work with him medically, that all kind of went away. Because the thing is, he's a good doctor, and the patients always come first. So that overrides everything. And I heard that, you know, in one version or another, over and over again.
You have this one scene where one of the other doctors says, you know, I just don't work like that. And you describe where she was sitting and eating breakfast somewhere, and someone came up to her and said, would you take a look at this mark on my forehead? And she said, actually, I'm eating breakfast. And I had gotten so used, when I was reading the book, I thought, well, Lepre would have looked at it.
Yes, he would. Not only would he have looked at it, I mean, he would have, you know, just relished
taken out his
idea.
Obsidian scalpel,
yes,
and
right.
had a go at it.
And, you know, he, I mean, our narcoleptic friend recently emailed him a picture of a spider that was in her apartment, and she was nervous about it. She didn't know what kind of spider it was, and it was sort of late at night, And Dr. Lepre's wife, Kathy, was saying, you know, why are you looking at this spider, you know? And he was like, no, this is interesting, And he looked it up, and he figured out, you know, it was fine. It was not a poisonous spider. You know, no question too small.
I have a question. In all your travels, writings, and adventures, what's been most frustrating for you?
Oh, boy. Frustrating. Trying to think, I don't think of my job that way, you know. Favorite is like your children, you know. I just feel so lucky, basically, to get to do what I do, and to get to meet the people that I'm able to meet, and have access to or a window on their lives in a way that I wouldn't if I wasn't doing this job. So, I mean, of course there are, you know, logistical frustrations and travel frustrations and tremendous juggling, but those just sort of pale in comparison to the rewards that you get from being able to tell stories and being able to meet people and talk to people. So I don't know if that sounds too Pollyannish, but that is kind of the way I look at it.
Well, let's go with that. Yeah. Can you remember something very, very special that changed you in a way you didn't anticipate?
Oh, these are hard questions. Something that changed me in a way that I didn't anticipate. Well, there are a lot of things, but I guess I'm thinking the thing that maybe comes to mind right away is that I did a story several years ago about an 11-year-old girl with a very serious mental illness, and I spent a lot of time with her family, and we did a big story about how each person in her family was coping with this and how she was coping with it. And I basically almost kind of moved in with them for a while. And it was an extraordinary, very, very difficult, But they were, again, you know, fully named, and we were able to tell that story. And one of the things that I remember is that I have two children and two girls, and they were probably about 3 and 7 at the time. And I just remember one night driving home, it took me about an hour and a half to get home from this house, and I was driving home, and I remember calling up my husband and saying, boy, we are just so lucky. you know, just count our blessings, because just to see what this family is so devoted and what they were going through was extraordinary. And, you know, just to have something like that bump up against your personal life is very striking. And also the reaction that we got from that story, because, and sometimes identifying people fully and having people be able to tell their story is so meaningful for people who read it, beyond what you would think. And we got such an outpouring from that story of thank you for bringing this to us. Thanks to the family for their courage in coming forward to talk about something that can be so stigmatizing. So it was all, that was just one of many, but that was an eye-opening experience for me.
So it sounds to me as if this was a wonderful experience for you on very, very deep levels, and what you did was provide healing for many people who responded to hearing about this story.
Well, yeah, so, I hope so. Yeah.
That's really
and,
wonderful.
That's the, you know, when things like that happen. I've heard that in different ways from Island Practice, too. People, the narcolepsy community is just so grateful that we were able to bring that out, because, again, something with so much stigma. And people, I think, you know, I hesitate to speak for people on Nantucket, but I have heard from so many of them who were very appreciative that this book captures a view of Nantucket that most of us on the outside do not have. I mean, we think of it as this bastion of, you know, rich summer people, and in some ways it is, but there is a whole incredibly diverse, hardworking, year-round community that is living in this very expensive place, trying to piece together, you know, a living in the off season when it's, you know, not all sunshine and flowers, when, you know, it can be bleak, there's nothing going on, people go stir crazy. And I've heard a lot of from a lot of people who have been very appreciative that people are getting a window into that real community and not just the kind of fantasy community that we think of.
And Katie, for you, is there something very special that stood out for you among all the works that you have done?
Oh, my work as a journalist?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, me. I mean, I'm so in awe of Pam, and I think one thing we share actually is telling people's stories. And I wrote about technology for a very long time for the New York Times. Lately, I've been doing only healthcare. And I have to say, just like Pam, there is nothing like writing about this unbelievably important topic, especially, I did a story recently, I have to say the most important story I think I've ever done, about death with dignity. I went up to Seattle and visited someone who was dying of ALS, who had chosen to get a prescription, an overdose of a barbiturate, and take it. When he said, you know, he would basically, he said, it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. He would know when it was time to go. And he said one of the best quotes from him was, you know, it's my life, it's my death, and it's my choice. And I've never been quite so moved writing a story like that. And there's just something about this healthcare beat that is, and you feel so privileged when you come upon people like that. It was one of the stories I think I had a lot of you know, reporters are supposed to be completely neutral and without emotion when you write this stuff, but it's really hard when you do a story like that.
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our program. I want to remind our audience that we'll be book signing after the program tonight. And when we do close our program, we remind our radio audience that we are the Commonwealth Club of California. I'd like to thank Pam and Katie for giving us the privilege of hearing their stories and telling us what their experiences have been about. It's really been a wonderful evening for us. So our thanks to Pam Bellick and Katie Hafner for bringing Island Practice and the wisdom and understanding of their work to us. I'm Ann Clark, and the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion, is now adjourned.